Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest tonight is Blair Rodman, author of Kill Phil. Also, he's a blackjack player, golfer, sports bettor. We'll be talking to Blair in a few minutes. In the news this week, we heard that Jackie Gaughan has died at the age of 93. Jackie was one of the movers and shakers in Las Vegas, particularly downtown Las Vegas. He was a friend and contemporary of Benny Binion, Sam Boyd, and a mentor to people like Steve Wynn. His son, Michael Gaughan, owns the South Point and was on this show several months ago talking about Benny Binion, who he knew well. Perhaps we can impose on Michael Gaughan to come on the show later and talk about his father. In some bizarre gambling news, a New Zealand man got to drinking and playing poker, lost a hand, and so he had to legally change his name to Full Metal Havoc, more sexy and intelligent than Spock and all the superheroes combined with Frost Nova. Since it was only 99 letters, it was a legal name in that country, and it appears on all his legal documents. This does seem to be a good argument not to go drinking when you play poker. It also seems to be a good case where if you lose, you try to work out a buyout arrangement, such as, "For I'll give you $10,000 in cash and I get to keep my old name." Any thoughts on this, Richard?
I love the story when I read it just because it reminded me of Brian Zembeck, the man with the $100,000 breasts.
Yes.
Who I'm sure would have changed his name to something like this if he had had the opportunity to win a bet. And I've actually been working on getting him on the show. He's a bit of a hermit, but I'm still working on it. So hopefully we'll get him one of these days.
All right. There have been three different lawsuits, including four plaintiffs, who are claiming they were inappropriately roughened up by security guards at Harrah's Atlantic City. This is surprising to me. Harrah's has enough public relation problems without this. Perhaps they can't get good guards or can't train them well enough, but it seems that this shouldn't be that difficult for them to put a stop to that if they really wanted to. Richard, what are your thoughts?
This surprised me, too. I thought that casinos were learning their lesson. Certainly, the behavior has changed in Las Vegas. There's no question that they are a lot more polite in backing people off than they used to be. I'm not saying it never happens, but it's a lot less than it used to happen. And there have been so many lawsuits against, Harrah's properties. This is just surprising that I guess back east they aren't getting the memo. But they lose a few six-figure lawsuits, and that should start to change their behavior.
I would think. Last week on the air, I recommended a free online course in irrational behavior taught by Dan Ariely, currently at Duke University. My Tuesday column this week was about suggesting people take this course as well. So, Richard, did I pressure you into taking it? And if so, how are you liking the course so far?
I did sign up, and it's a subject that I've been interested in the past. I'm really enjoying it already so far. I talked my partner, Daryl, into signing up. He's taking it as well. We're both enjoying it. I thank you for that.
So there is about 3 hours of video in the first week. I'm speeding it up to 1.25 to make it easy to do so. So Dan talks a bit faster then. And So it takes me 2.25 hours or so. How fast are you going, Richard?
I sped it up to 1.5. And with the main instructor, that was fine. There are a couple of guest lecturers at the end where that was pretty quick. They tend to talk faster than he does. But yeah, I went through it at 1.5 and I didn't feel like I was missing anything.
Yes. Now, it's interesting. There's some quizzes. I haven't taken the quizzes yet. But there are quizzes. And on the homepage of this site, there's this interesting box that says, do not click here. Under any circumstances, don't click here. So have you clicked yet, Richard?
I have not. I don't intend to. I'm sure it's some kind of, he gathers a lot of data. He does a lot of experimentation. So I'm sure it's a test to how many people can't restrain themselves from clicking there. But I won't.
Yeah, nor will I. That does not seem to be very compelling at all. But I think you can still sign up for it until the start of the second week's lecture. The second week's lecture is going to be posted on Tuesday, which I think the first week's lecture will be taken down at that point. So if you're interested in it, and both of us recommend it, the course is, organization is called Coursera, Coursera.org. If you go there, you'll find it. It's and it's free, and you'll enjoy it. So let's talk to our guest. I met Blair Rodman in the mid-1990s. It's all Anthony Curtis's fault. Every New Year's Eve day, Anthony Curtis would host this big party where if you heard about it, you were invited. And I heard about it because I contributed to the newsletter, and Blair heard about it because he'd been a friend of Anthony since the 80s or maybe before. And enough of these over time, Blair and I figured we might as well learn to like each other. Blair has been playing in the World Series of Poker for almost 30 years. He has numerous caches, something like, dozens. Last year he had 4 relatively minor caches. He has 1 first place bracelet, which came in 2007 in a $2,000 no limit hold'em tournament with more than 2,000 entrants. I would consider him an old time gambler, playing mainly by feel, as opposed to a lot of the new young gamblers who do everything by mathematics. Clearly, one can be successful either way. We've had Stanford Wong on the show, and one time he spoke about his casino tournament strategy book. The way that book came about is Blair Rodman, along with Anthony Curtis and some others, went out and played and entered primarily blackjack tournaments, and then they figured out how to win. So as a player, it's a whole lot easier to master the strategy delineated by somebody else than it is to figure out a successful strategy from scratch. My hat's off to these guys, and it's very much what Munchkin and I try to do in both our writings and also this program. Blair Rodman, welcome to Gambling with an Itch.
Hi, Bob. Glad to be here.
I'm doing well. Now, there's a story about you winning some video poker machines at the Mint. If this is the Mint in Las Vegas we're talking about, it must have been a long time ago because that casino was incorporated into Binion's Horseshoe in 1986. So, what happened?
Yeah, it was. It was probably a year or two before that. They were giving away, they had a promotion, they were giving away a video poker machine every day to whoever scored the most points. And you get points for Royals, points for different things. So we went in and started playing. There's maybe 6 of us. And we played every day. We played hard. If somebody hit a Royal, you were probably going to win. And then there was one other team that came in and started playing. So we made a deal with them. We said, look, whoever hits the Royal will quit for the day. So we won't, bang against each other. And we ended up winning 18 of the machines.
Uh-huh. How big was your group?
I think there was 6 of us. So we had the reason we did it was one of the guys had a friend whose father was a big wheel in one of the casinos, and he told us that we could sell the machines to him, no problem. You win them. They're brand new machines. They're probably worth about $8,000 apiece, new at the time. And he said, if you win them, we'll buy them from you, blah, blah, blah. Looked like a great promotion. So we won 18 of them, and then we had the machines. We said, okay, it's time to sell them. He goes, well, we got a problem. I said, what's that problem? He said, you can't sell them without an unrestricted gaming license. And we're like, oops.
Oh, God.
So now we got 18 video poker machines and nothing to do with them. So we're like, oh, this is horrible. I mean, you know, you can't get an unrestricted gaming license. That's, you know, ridiculous. I mean, that's a two-year ordeal and costs you hundreds of thousands. So we put them in a warehouse. We each took one home, and we put the rest of them in the warehouse. We had about, you know, 12 or 13 in a warehouse. So we sat on them for a while, and all of a sudden, one of the guys comes in and says, I find a guy that can buy them. I said, really? He says, is it legal? And he says, yeah, it's legal. We're like, I don't think it's really legal, but at that point, we were desperate. So
he'll pay cash.
Yeah, he did. He paid us $3,000 apiece for them. So we were very happy. You know, it was profitable. I'm like, wow. So that was it. We got our money. We went on a happy way. I remember I came home one day and I put the TV on and I see and the news says casino owner busted in Henderson. And it was one of those little casinos on the Boulder Highway out in Henderson. And they got a camera on. They're showing our machines. Apparently what he did is he just took the machines and stuck them against a wall and turned them on and started playing them. He never registered them, never got licenses for them. And I'm like, oh, boy, because my name was about six of them. You have to fill all those paperwork. I'm like, oh, they're going to be banging on my door pretty soon. But they never came, which really shocked me. So they came in. They carted them all off. I don't know where they're at now, but it was a little scary.
Yeah, I'll bet.
That's funny. So how did you first get into gambling? You started as a blackjack player, right?
No, I didn't. I've always played poker since when I was a little kid. I grew up in upstate New York, in Troy, New York, if anyone knows that. And we didn't have much to do, so we gambled. I mean, I started playing poker when maybe I was 8 years old. And by the time I was 12, we summered out on a lake called Babcock Lake outside of Troy. And there was card games there. Everybody played poker. So when I was 12, I was playing with 17, 18-year-olds. And I won all the time. And it's like, wow, this is great. But I figured out later, the only reason I won, I had a very simple strategy. I just played tighter than everybody else. You know, it's your typical home game where they played every hand. And if you don't play every hand, you play tighter than they do, you're going to win no matter how, you know, what your other skills are. So I always liked to play. And when I got to college at 76, I had $400, an old car, and I just threw what I could in the back seat, and I started driving west because I didn't want to stay in upstate New York anymore. And ended up in Vegas. I had some friends in California. I bounced around there for about 4 years and did a bunch of different things and came to Vegas in 1980. And I was working for actually a waterbed store, setting up waterbeds. And I said, I'm going to, you know, start playing poker and go to get a job. So I went to dealer school and I got a job dealing crafts at the El Cortez in 1981. So I went from there. So now I started playing poker. At the time, I didn't know hold'em. I was playing seven-card stud. I played lots of the small stud games, and I tried to build up a bankroll. When I built up a bankroll, I'd quit my job. I'd play, and if I went broke, I'd go back and get another job. So I had several craps-dealing jobs, and I bounced back and forth like that. And my big break was what we were talking about when Anthony told me, you know, Stanford Wong is, you know, wants to do this thing with casino tournaments. And I told him about you, and he said, okay, you know, we'll take another player on. So that was probably 85, maybe, and 85, 86. So he bankrolled it, and we started traveling the world playing not just blackjack tournaments, but baccarat and craps and keno and horse racing. And, you know, he figured out a way to beat all these tournaments. And at the time, it was fairly easy. So we did all kinds of things. I mean, Caesars had a keno tournament. It was 50,000 first place. We figured out it would cost us about 10,000 to get the high score. We destroyed that for several years until other people figured it out and came in and diluted it so much you couldn't do it anymore. Same thing with horse racing tournaments, blackjack tournaments. The craps were my favorite because I knew craps better than the other guys. But we just played those for 5 years maybe until probably around the end of the 80s, early 90s, when the casino started throwing out the good players and basically had to be invited. And, you know, we couldn't play it anymore. And it wasn't worth trying to weasel your way in. So we just went on to other things.
Mm. Were you ever a card counter? Were you ever a blackjack player?
Functional. You know, I consider myself a great tournament player, but just as playing cash blackjack, I would rather play poker. So I never really got into the cash game blackjack.
You do some sports betting. How is sports betting today different than it was, say, in the 90s?
It's a whole new ball game in a lot of ways. That's what happened, actually, when we stopped doing the casino tournament. So it was around 89 or 90. And one of the guys said, I have a friend who's a high-level government computer programmer, and he thinks he can beat the NBA. I said, okay, let's give it a shot. We didn't have, you know, couldn't play the casino tournaments anymore, so let's get a, take a shot at this. So we did, and started out with four of us. And two of us were out in the streets running around making bets, which I was one of them, and another friend. And the other two guys were doing the handicapping. And it took us about 2 years before we really started getting it and getting the program ironed out and all the other things we needed to do. And then we were off from there. We really did well. It was funny. I had this fishing vest with about 90 different pockets in it. And I would go out in the morning, about 8 in the morning. I'd go to Stardust, where the line originated back then, and play their lottery early. We had our line, we'd get our bets in, and then I would travel from there. I would go downtown, and I'd hit all the casinos downtown and make the bets, and then I would go up to the strip, and I would park at usually Mirage, and then I would go around, and I would hit the Sands, Harrah's, all the way up the strip, you know, all the way up to Little Caesars, come back through the dunes, and just make my bets every morning. And at the time,
now,
there was no...
This was before the era of cell phones. What were you doing, calling in on payphones all the time?
Started out on payphones. Then we went to walkie-talkies. It was also before the Don Best screen or any of the computer. You know, the internet was just kicking off then. So I'll tell you one thing that we did, which was brilliant. One of our guys came up with the idea of having clipping services in every city that had a sports team. And in the morning, they would fax us the sports pages. And when we got in the office, we would have the sports page from every city in the country. So we knew things that nobody knew. I mean, we had injuries back then. You know, it's hard to relate to now because there's so much information out there. And you get your papers online. You can get the Don Best screen. They give you all the injuries. But back then, you know, one thing we had to do, betting as much money as we're betting, we had to wait till 4 o'clock till the New York bookies came up because that's where we bet most of our money. So we had to sit on, even if we got these injuries, we had to sit on them all day and hope nobody found them out. And amazingly, nobody did. I mean, we would just wait till, you know, we had a famous game we had. Elijah on was out for Houston, and we knew it at 8 o'clock in the morning, and nobody knew it until the game went off, and we pounded them. And next day we called up a guy. His name was Chubby. He was a bookmaker. And he said, okay, Chubby, today we want the Knicks minus two. He goes, all right, who died on the Knicks? But it was a whole different ballgame back there. Betting the money was different. You had to use movers. You had to use guys in the street.
What is a mover?
A mover is somebody who will make bets for you. Say you call up when you want to go out on a game. Let's say you want the Knicks minus two. You'll have a bunch of numbers to call. Now, back then, we would have guys calling the bookies, but you would also call your movers. Your movers are guys that had outs. Outs are places to bet. And they had outs who had outs who had outs. It's like a web. So when we were hot and winning, you know, regularly and really destroying it, we hit, you know, our movers through all the stuff that people were following us, we'd hit pretty much every bookmaker in the country. And for a couple of years there, we were so hot, we were moving NBA totals 5 or 6 points, and they never come back. You know, now if you ever see him go that far, somebody's got to buy him back and try for the middle. We were so hot, nobody bought him back. They just went 5 or 6 points and stayed there, and we destroyed them.
Wow. Yeah. Do you know how big your edge was?
You know, I don't know how big the edge was, but it was pretty significant back then. Our biggest edge was with the injuries, honestly. When people didn't have all the injury information, that was when we got a big injury, we did real well. Our other program won. It was a steady winner, but it wasn't a huge winner. But situational things. The other thing we did is once the, you know, we read the clippings, and once the internet came up, we read every single sports page every single day looking for coaches' game plans because we bet a lot of NBA totals. So you would pick up lots of gems there. The coach says, you know, we're going to stress defense tonight or we're not going to let them run with us or that kind of thing. That stuff was very valuable. If they're going to sit a player, those kinds of things. The program was pretty sophisticated, and he kept improving it. And it won till the end of the 90s when it started to slow down some, and it wasn't as profitable as it was, mainly because of the information was out there and the competition was greater at the time. But we had a pretty good edge we had a really good 10-year run. You know, we got into college football. We got into hockey. it was I used to bet at the Mirage, and the sport, you know, the first when I first started there, that the manager was Jimmy Vaccaro, who was great. You know, he knew, he understood gamblers. He let us do what we wanted. You know, we couldn't, you know, we couldn't bet the house, but he gave us, you know, he respected us and let us bet when we needed to bet. And then they hired a guy named Robert Walker, came in. He was a bean counter. And, you know, essentially Steve Wynn said, Steve Lynn was at war with Billy Walters and did not want Billy beating his sports books no matter what. So he got in there and basically just neutered his sports book. And they brought in Robert Walker, and he really didn't know that much about sports. He wasn't an old-timer like Jimmy. So it was harder with him, but he still let me bet because I explained to him, said, look, Robert, I'm either going to come in here and bet you and you're going to know where the steam's coming from, or you're going to be on your own and you're going to get hit for more than I'm going to bet with you. So I said, let me bet 5,000 game or 10,000 game or whatever, and now you'll understand where the steam's coming from. I said, okay, that's good. And it worked for quite a while. And we beat him in basketball. We beat him in football. And I remember we started doing hockey, and I said, Robert, I said, what? He says, we're going to do hockey now. He goes, oh, my God, really? And we destroyed hockey. You know, we bet nothing but underdogs who were all overpriced. And I swear we changed the whole hockey market because for about a year we just destroyed hockey. It was great.
You mentioned
So what do you do now? How do you find the edges now, now that everybody has the information? And
you know, it's harder now and it's different. What I do basically is shop lines, look for weak lines. That kind of thing, a little bit of handicapping, but I don't fool myself and think I'm a handicapper. The guys that are beating handicapping are so sophisticated now that, you know, there's no way I can compete with them. But if I get, you know, books, if I have as many outs as I can get and I have books that are slow to move or I see situations that I think are right, then I'll play them. Mm. It's not like it used to be. There's still people out there doing it. There's still huge movers with huge accounts. You know, offshore, most of what Billy Walters bets now is offshore because the Vegas casinos just went to war. They did everything they could to stop him from betting, so I think he just gave up on it. And that's why if you go in and you look at a line screen, like Anthony has on LVA Sports or the Don Best screen, the Las Vegas lines are quite a bit different than the offshore lines. You know, they'll be a point or two different because Billy or his guys will hit the offshore lines. They'll move, and the Vegas lines will still sit there. So you can, if you want to go out and look for weak lines as far as that goes and compare them, you can find some stuff that's positive.
Hmm. By comparing the offshore lines to the Vegas lines.
Yeah.
All right. Poker. Nevada has 3 online casinos.
Mm-hmm.
Have you played any or all of them? Do you have any preferences?
I haven't played much. They're not great. The player pool's not there. The games I really want to play aren't there. So I've played very little. Online. It's just not my thing. It never was really my thing, except I was able to play games that, you know, when I came up playing poker, we played limit poker. And we played games like Stud 8 or Better or Limit Omaha 8 or Better, that kind of thing. So I really love when Full Tilt and Poker Stars were in full swing because you could find decent-sized games in those games which weren't spread anywhere anymore in the live games. So that's what I really liked about the online. But now these sites in Nevada aren't big enough yet. The player pool is not big enough to support those games. So I don't really mess with it.
So what do you like to play when you go out to play now?
You know, I don't play that much anymore. I'm kind of stuck playing no limit. I might play some limit once in a while. Omaha 8 or Better is still, you can find games here or there. But I don't play that much live except during the World Series, which is the only poker. I just got burned out on it. So the World Series of Poker is what turns me on still. You know, that's poker heaven for about 2 months a year.
So how many events do you expect to enter this year?
I'm not sure. I'm cutting back because it's just so hard physically. The last couple of years I played maybe 12 or 14. Back in 04 or 05 or when it was, you know, I was really into it, I was playing – up, you know, maybe up to 30 events a year. But that's, you have to be in shape. It's just, it's so grueling. It's really, really hard. You know, when I won that bracelet, I'd been up for 5 days in a row with just very, very little sleep and made the mistake of drinking, you know, energy drinks. So they got me through the day, but then I couldn't sleep at night and then I have to do it. I mean, I was really totally exhausted. It's tough. It's a tough gig. That's why the kids are winning. Because number one, they're so in tune with poker, and it's all they do. They have the eye of the tiger. And number two, they're just in better shape. They can focus longer and physically sit there longer.
Being 25 is different than being 55.
Or, tell me about it.
Yes.
You're 60 in a couple of weeks.
Ah. Yeah, I think people don't realize how physically demanding, you know, even chess, you know, chess players have to be in good shape to.
You do. You have to be physically in shape to be able to focus mentally for those long hours. You know, if your body's breaking down, your mind's going to break down.
So now you've sat at the table against Phil Ivey. Is he the best?
You know, he probably is. I don't know. That some of these kids are so good now. It would be hard to say he is, but his records show that he is. But I haven't played enough hours with Phil. You know, I've played with him in tournaments. I haven't played cash games with him because he's just out of my price range. He's obviously a great player. It's really hard to quantify who's the best because there's so much variance in poker.
Who else is at the top of your list of the guys that you have the most respect for?
You know, of the kids, I mean, obviously Phil Hellmuth has had a great record, so it's hard to discount Phil. I don't care what everybody says about him. He is a great no-limit tournament player. Guys like Phil Galfond, some of these other kids, there's so many of them. There's so many, you know, Antonio obviously has done very, very well. And Brian Rast is very good. I don't know. There's legions of them. That's the problem. You sit down at a no-limit tournament today with 2,000 players, 1,000 of them can play. I mean, play really well. And you know, there's hardly any absolute fish like there used to be. You know, the level of poker education has gone up so much that everybody's gotten better. So to really have an edge, it's tough to find, and the rake keeps going higher and higher. So, you know, I just wrote an article for All In. I write for All In monthly, and just about how hard it is to get started now. Because when you're at the lowest levels, the rake is so high, you just really don't have any win. You have to be really lucky or win some, you know, little tournaments and go on a run to get a bankroll. And then avoid all the traps of blowing off your bankroll. So it's really, really hard to get started now from nothing or from a small bankroll.
If you were going to get started, though, what books would you recommend starting players?
I would always recommend the book that did it for me was David Sklansky's. It was called Poker Theory at the time. I think it still is. It changed. It might have been Winning Poker for a while, but it's. I think it's called Poker Theory still. And when I was first starting out, I got that book, and I must have read it 20 times. And then I had an aha moment, and I finally got it. I understood. Because it's not about a specific game. It's about poker theory. It's about the basics of poker. And once you understand that, you can basically play any game. So you start from there, and then find which game you want to play, which is no limit now. There's tons of great books out there. Ed Miller has done a lot of books that cover the games that most players play 2-5 no limit, 5-10, the smaller no limit games that you find at every casino. His books are really, really good. There's tons of books. You know, tournament books. Harrington's books were the best, but now there's more coming out. You know, Lee Nelson and I wrote Kill Phil back in 2004, and that was kind of a specific book to. We can talk about Kill Phil if you want. But anyway, Lee went on to write some other great books called Kill Everyone, The Razor's Edge. They're coming out with a new one real soon. That set of books for tournament play is excellent. And if anybody wants to really learn how to play tournaments, that's where I would start.
We asked Anthony Curtis what we should ask you tonight. You've been friends with Anthony for 30 years or something like that.
Yeah.
He says there was a good story about when the two of you were tossed out of the pepper mill in Reno. Is that something you can share with us?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It's the only time I was ever thrown out of a casino.
That's actually hard to believe.
Yeah, well, I told you, I didn't play much cash game blackjack, but we were up at the pepper mill. This had to be probably in the 80s, maybe early 90s, and we were, we're hole carding. And Anthony, we got done. Anthony went up to the drink. You know, Pepper was a beautiful casino. We're sitting up there with a big fruity drink. And, you know, he wouldn't like me saying that. But, all right, we're drinking beer. But anyway, this gigantic this gigantic security guard comes up to us. Says, all right, guys, show me some ID. And we're like, no. You know, they give you that look. Like, no. I said, show me some ID. We're like, no, I don't think so. He says, he didn't know what to do. Like, they never know what to do. And I said, okay. He says, wait right here. Okay. So we're sitting there drinking and kind of laughing, and now this kid comes up, he's probably about 21 years old, and he's, you know, the kid of somebody who's a big wig at the Peppermill. You know, come on downstairs. All right, we'll go downstairs with you. You know, we walk downstairs, and he says, all right, get in this room. I'm like, I'm not going in that room. Are you crazy? I'll leave, but I'm not going. He's getting in the room, and he got all up in her face, and I'm ready to, like, all right, you know, you want me in that room, you have to throw me in that room. And I look in there, and there's two of our other guys sitting there. They're just laughing. He's, come on in, come on in. He says, all right, we'll come in. So we go in there and sit there, and it's all right, show me some ID. No, I don't think so. Now this kid's losing his mind, right? And we'll call the police. Yeah, do that, please, call the police. I'm not kidding. Okay, call the police. So they call the police. The cops come. All right, now, show us some ID. So I'm not showing it to you, but I'll show it to him, you know, meaning the cop. He says, all right. So I give it to him, and he's looking. And the other kid comes over to try to look at it, and the cop goes, get out of here. You're not looking at it. He says, oh, that's funny. So that's fine. We're sitting in there, and now the kid's really beside himself because he can't intimidate us, and he doesn't know what to do. You know, they couldn't prove we were doing anything, and we weren't doing anything illegal anyway. So he says, all right, get out of here. You know, Register Trespass Act, even though he didn't know who we were. And so, okay. So Anthony and I are outside. We're walking down the sidewalk, walking out. There's the carport or the valet, and we're walking down to the street, and we're laughing and giggling. We turn around, and there's this car. We see this car. We hear this car beside it because the radio, you know, the security guard was in the car, and he had his radio on. And he says, they're right there now. They're walking down the hot sidewalk. We could hear him. So we just turned around and laughed at him, and he just shrugged. It's like, okay. All right, guys. But it was all fairly amusing. One of our guys got thrown out of a phone booth, which was one of the funniest things.
Thrown out of a phone booth.
He was playing at the, what was the name of it? Not the King 8. It was the one that's a truck stop. You know, in the one munch, it's on the way out of town in Reno. It's a truck stop. They have one down here, too.
Oh, Boomtown?
Boomtown. So he got thrown out of Boomtown. So he said, all right. He didn't have a car because the guys had left him there. They're going to pick up later. So he walks. He says, I'll walk down to the phone booth and call him. So he walks about a quarter mile down to a phone booth, and he's in there ready to dial. And security comes screaming up. He says, we own this property. That's our phone booth. Get out of the phone booth. So they wouldn't let him make a phone call. So he threw him out of the phone booth. I'm sure you guys, I mean, the blackjack players have millions of stories like that. It's really pretty amusing. I'll tell you one good one that happened. We were playing I wasn't there, but they were playing a baccarat tournament in Jamaica and or Puerto Rico.
Yeah, and I was going to say, I don't think Jamaica has any casinos.
Yeah, it was Puerto Rico, and two of the guys got to the finals. And once they got to the finals, somebody called them or somebody told them who they were. And we were kind of infamous at the time. And they came up and they said, that's it. You're not playing this tournament. We're going to throw you out, blah, blah, blah. And he said, oh, geez, you know. That night, this gigantic hurricane was coming in. So they had to get everybody out of there and off the island. So they had no choice but to just divide up the prize money and pay everybody. So they ended up getting paid, and we got out of there anyway.
So now a lot of these young poker players have taken up golf, and that seems to be one of your major games these days. So is there a lot of money to be made on the golf course with these guys?
You know, some of them. I actually played with some of them last week down in L.A., and, you know, they don't quite understand it. Golf gambling is a pretty different world. You know, when Negrano and Eric Lindgren and those guys first came up, they thought they were going to go out and take off Doyle and, you know, Chip Reese and, on the golf course. And they learned some very expensive lessons. You know, there was an interesting incident. It had to be 10 years ago now with Phil Ivey, who was playing these guys from England. And they had been beating Phil up pretty good. And so he went out and he got mad and he practiced and he got really, really good and came out and played them and destroyed them. And they said, it's not fair. You lied about your handicap. You didn't tell us you'd gotten this much better, and we're not going to pay you. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. You don't have a clue. And they're like, well, all these guys from England basically, you know, stood up. Golf's a game of honor, and you know, he lied about it, and he shouldn't get paid, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, my God. So I couldn't help myself. I wrote a long article about it. I said, look, you know, what you're doing isn't playing golf. You're gambling. Golf is just a medium. And you need to understand what game you're playing. You know, you're not playing golf anymore. It's not a gentleman's game. And if you walk up there with your eyes closed and think you're going to get a fair game, you're not. You got to learn how to protect yourself. You know, you're playing in an arena that you don't understand. But within that arena, it's just like playing poker. In poker, you're trying to deceive people. When you're on a first tee in a golf, you know, making a golf game, you're probably going to get lied to. You know, I mean, that's not what I do, really, because I think I, you know, there's two ways to play golf for money. One is to get a better handicap than you deserve. The other one is to just play better for the money than the other guys. And that's my thing. I don't choke for the money, and I usually beat guys if we're even and we have a fair game. But I know other guys that'll end up with two shots the best of it off the first tee, and it's pretty hard to lose when you do that. So it's you know, it's a whole different ball game, and golf is just a medium, but it's just gambling. That's all it is. It has very little to do with golf.
I always thought there was a ton of money to be made for somebody who really could play golf well. I mean, or and match up well. I mean,
yeah,
that was the other thing.
I mean, there's some. Well. Yeah, there's some real hustlers out there. You know, there's guys that think, you know, this is what they do. I mean, they come out with a funky swing, and you know, they can break par whenever they want, and they'll shoot 80 on, you know, four rounds in a row, and then you'll finally get a big game, and then they destroy you, and they'll, you know, they'll shoot what they want. You know, the famous story was Titanic Thompson could break par left-handed or right-handed. I mean, he could have played on a tour easy, but it would have cost him too much money. But he had famous matches with all kinds of pro golfers. You know, in those days, the pro golfers, they gambled because they weren't making any other money. But he was brutal on the golf course. He was great.
Yeah, I heard he would, you know, just barely win the front nine and then say, "You're so bad, I'll play left-handed on the back nine if we double the bet."
Yeah. Yeah,
he and he was actually better left-handed than right.
Yeah, I love the Titanic Thompson stories. He wasn't a very nice guy, but he was the best hustler ever. I mean, he was pretty amazing. You know, all those guys, all those old-timers. When I first got to town, I'd play poker with Johnny Moss and, you know, some of these other old-timers. They were the bigger the name, the nastier they were. They were mean, nasty guys. And I was shocked. They really were. I mean, it was a different group of people. You know, poker right now is dominated by a bunch of nerdy kids, essentially.
Uh-huh.
And in the old days, it was all the Texas, you know, street guys who grew up in the Depression and you know, had to scrap for every dime they made. And they were some mean guys. And they knew how to get the money. But, you know, Johnny
Moss. Did you run into being cheated back with those guys?
I'm sure I did. There's a couple incidents where I'm pretty sure I got cheated. There's probably a lot of them where I didn't know it that I was getting cheated. But I'm sure I did in those days, you know, especially the earliest days. But I didn't play big enough in those days to really run into the big cheaters. But I did probably toward the end of the 80s, I did. And I probably got cheated in a number of different spots. But I was still making money, so it's, you know, you do what you can do to protect yourself. But,
yeah,
you know, good car cheaters and some of the stuff they have, is you can't fight it. There's just no way.
Do you think the game is more honest today than it was 30 years ago in this town?
I think it is. I don't think it's as honest as the kids think it is. I think, you know, some of these kids are shocked when they hear of somebody doing something dishonest. You know, they're a little naive because, like I said, they're nerdy kids that have never been out in the streets, and, you know, they're not hustlers. They're nerdy math majors, you know. So, but I think it's much better than it used to be. I think there's things going on that still, you know, but not as much as it used to be. It's changed. You know, the supervision's better. I think they take it more seriously, although not as seriously as I think they should. But again, the problem is it's not their money. It's not the casino's money. As long as the rate keeps dropping, it affects them. But I don't think they understand how it affects them. You know, their goal is to keep the games going for as long as possible. So if people are cheating, it's going to break people sooner, and their games are going to break down. But most casino people, they don't understand that, and they don't put, I think, the effort they need to into policing these games.
Yeah, especially if somebody on the inside is in on it, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, there's all kinds of things that happen. You know, online, to me, is a kind of a cesspool. I hope they can clean it up, but it's pretty hard to stop two guys being on an IM or, you know, telling each other your cards or whatever. It's pretty hard to stop. The bigger sites are trying. You know, PokerStars tried. They're still trying. I think they do a fairly good job with IP addresses and that kind of thing. But the really sophisticated guys, I mean, I saw pictures of Scandinavian guys. There were six of them in a room, and they were all playing in the same game. And they weren't, you know, they weren't that hiding it that much. I mean, the picture was on the internet. I mean, there's, you know, internet's, it's tough, you know, it's tough to trust. Yeah, it's tough to trust any game when it's just for money. You know, people are going to cheat. I mean, people are going to take advantage. If they can't beat it honestly, they're going to try to cheat. So, but on the internet, it's kind of too easy. I hope that when it gets legalized and there's more regulation and there's more effort put into it, that the games will be cleaner, and I think they will. So we'll have to wait and see. That's a whole nother ball of wax.
Yeah. So you're, what is the majority of your gambling time? What is the majority of your day now? Is it working on sports or?
Yeah, it's pretty much working on sports. The poker's coming up. I need to get back in poker shape, so I'm going to start playing poker again. But right now, it's mostly been sports. I do some writing and, you know, play golf and things like
that.
I
have to say, by the way, I mean, I hate to bug people because I know how hard it is to write, but I was a big fan of your blog and it just sort of disappeared. So
yeah, I don't think it was getting read very much and it was a lot of work. And I might
bring it back. It is a lot of work. I know that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, writing's hard. I mean, I, you know, doing these articles is hard. They come up every month like, oh, geez, I got to do another one. It is hard. You know, I think I write pretty well, but it takes me a long time. I'm not one of these people who can sit down and, you know, bang out an article in a half hour. It takes me thought and time and editing and, you know, to get it right. So, yeah, it's tough. No, I liked writing the blog, too, and maybe someday I'll bring it back.
So you mentioned you're writing for All In Magazine. I didn't realize that was back in business.
It is. It started up about maybe 6 months ago was their first issue. They got some new injection of cash from some investors who are basically running it.
Is it an online magazine or is it a print?
Oh, it's a print magazine. It's in quite a few casinos. And
it's a casino freebie in most cases.
It is, yeah. And they lost their website. Their goal is to be the biggest poker website out there. And the website's pretty good. You know, you can get the articles on there, and they also have some other stuff. They're working on it. It's a work in progress, but I think they're doing a pretty good job.
Huh.
Are they anywhere near the size of, like, Card Player website?
The website? Well, Card Player...
been around a while.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest website is 2+2, the biggest poker website, which is still huge. Card Player, I don't go on Card Player very much. It was funny, Card Player is a great magazine, still is. But the day they passed the law, you know, Black Friday in 2011, the next issue was half the size that it was.
Because all the online ads were taken out.
Yeah, that really hurt poker. Hurt it really, really bad. You know, we thought it was going to hurt it in 2006, but when that, you know, the Full Tilt and, you know, some of them decided to stay here, it didn't. It actually grew quite a bit. But 2011, April 15th, right? Or I think it was April 15th. That really just put the kibosh on everything. And, yeah, the TV shows, everything. It made it harder for players. You know, their sponsorships dried up. I think one of the real bad things for American players is the internet was the greatest learning tool out there to learn how to play poker. You play with millions of hands and, you know, learn everything. And now when you can't play that, the rest of the world, the places where it's legal, are catching up. So, you know, the kids that have had bankrolls, you know, from 2004 to 2007 or even 2011, it was easy to... build up bankrolls, you know, especially in the early years. And some of these kids took them, and now they can afford to move to Canada or go to Mexico and play. But like I said, for guys coming up right now, they don't have many outs. They can't really go to, you know, Mexico and learn how to play. And the price or the player pools here are pretty small, so it's a tough gig. And the rake's brutal online. I mean, you play so many hands, and you know, in the one way that Full Tilt or PokerStars survived was. And the players survived was they had all kinds of incentives if you played a lot of hands. So they had lots of people starting games and playing 18, 24 games at a time and hoping to break even and make their money on the rake back they would get or, the, you know, whatever kind of spiffs they would get back. These new sites, their rake back's really tough to earn from what I saw. I don't think you can really do it the same way. And I think their rake's higher than it was on some of the other sites. So it's very, very hard.
One of the biggest debates among poker players these days is the clock and whether or not they should put a clock on tournaments. Do you have any opinion on that one way or the other?
That's very funny. That's the article I'm finishing up tomorrow.
I didn't know that.
Here's my opinion on it. I think the game, as slow as it is now, it's very damaging. It turns a lot of people off who are there to have fun and they don't want to sit there and watch some, you know, kid, you know, Hollywood for 3 minutes over every hand. I mean, it's just terrible. It's unfair to the people at that table because the more hands you get in a tournament, the better chance you have of building a bankroll. So, yeah, I think something needs to be done. My idea is, you know, instead of having a shot clock, I played in one last week in Commerce in L.A., and they had a shot clock. It was it was a logistical nightmare. They had these little timers on the table, and it was supposed to beep when it got a certain number of seconds, and it didn't beep, and guys are sitting there, didn't know what was going on. All of a sudden, the dealer's grabbing their cards, and it was pretty unwieldy. I played them in Australia like 10 years ago. They had, it was actually called Speed Poker, and it was live speed poker. There's a now what they're calling speed poker online is it was rush poker on Full Tilt, where you play a hand and then as soon as you're out, the whole table changes and you play another hand. That's a whole different story. But the speed poker, it worked. They had it better set up, you know, with timers, and the dealers were better. They knew what to do. But I think, you know, there's lots of things. It's funny. Nowadays, there's problems with slow play and everything. You know, baseball games used to take 2 hours. Now they take four. Golf has always had a huge problem with it. You watch the end of a basketball game, they call 20 timeouts, and it just takes forever. It didn't used to be that way. But what golf did was they don't time people, but if you fall behind a group ahead, they give you a warning. If you don't catch up, then they can penalize you. I think they're a little too lax on penalizing them, but they do penalize people occasionally. I think there's a way in poker to track the number of rounds being played per table. And if one table's lagging behind a certain benchmark, give them a warning. If they continue to stay behind, then you give them a penalty. That way, then you put them on the clock. Now you have them on the clock. Or you can get, you know, and if there's somebody that's really egregious about it, you can give penalties. So this way, you wouldn't have a clock on every table, but you would be able to police the tables that are too slow and tell them, look, you need to hurry up or you're going on the clock. And you know, if it's one or two people, you're going to get penalties. You know, they want to say, you know, the players are, you know, peer pressure and they'll tell people to speed up, but they don't do it. And, you know, players are reluctant to call a clock on somebody. It just causes hard feelings and all those problems. But I'll guarantee you, if somebody comes to my table and gives me a warning saying you're playing too slow and it's like one or two guys, people are going to speak up and say, hey, it's on you. You guys need to speed up. And if it comes down to it and they put you on a clock and say, hey, floor man, it's these two guys. And if they keep doing it, give them the penalty, not us. And I think it would be a way, you know, a compromise, I think it would be effective.
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea. And, you know, I mean, in my own case, I want to be able to take time only on those occasions when I actually need to think about something, which is maybe one hand in 500 or something. You know what I mean?
Right.
It'd be nice to have a time bank where you had a certain amount of time banked, and when you say, okay, I want to go on the clock of my bank because I need to actually think about this hand. You know what I mean?
Yes, and I agree with you. Like I said, it's a little unwieldy to do it at every table and have a time bank for everybody. You can do it online, and I think they do it online. And I think it's a great idea. The one nice thing about online tournaments is you can do so much more as far as moving players and all the logistics of a tournament that are kind of clumsy in live tournaments. But, yeah, I agree with you. It would be nice to have a time bank. You know, it's there's actually, I mean, more problems with it. You know, if you're at the final table of the World Series of Poker, you don't want to put somebody on a clock or on a time bank or at the last two or three tables. But if it's the beginning of a tournament, you know, there's some of these, you know, I don't want to say kids, but I mean some of these young players that think it's right to take 15 seconds to fold every single hand because they think they're giving up something. If they don't, they'll fold too quickly. Well, that's just ridiculous. You're wasting everybody's time. You know, if you know you're going to fold your hand, just fold it. But you know,
and especially if the table is on television, they want more time on television.
Yeah, I know. And that's a problem. People like to act up on television. And I kind of hate being on especially the early television tables. They're more distracting than anything. You want to? Yeah. I'll tell you that the famous Anthony Curtis story.
We need to save that for after the commercials.
Okay.
And then we'll tell you how much time you have to do that. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. That's more than anybody else. They have a series of progressive bonuses in March, each starting at $10,000 and guaranteed to be hit by $25,000. These awards are given to slot and video poker players. Should you be playing while somebody else wins the award, you receive $20 in free play. Once the bonus jackpot hits, another one begins immediately. This goes on through the month, 24 hours a day. They have a smaller daytime progressive starting each day at 11 at 1,000, guaranteed to be hit by 2,500. If you play when that progressive is live, you're eligible for both bonuses. The free video poker class, the South Point, next Wednesday at noon will be NSU Deuces Wild. For 3 weeks in a row, we'll be having Deuces Wild variations, including Deuces Bonus and Deuces Double Bonus. Attend these and you'll become very competent in knowing how strategies change with different pay schedules.
Deuces Wild is one of those games where there are dozens of different pay schedules. Learning how they change is not difficult, but many players don't know how to do this. At the Palms, the March drawings have a different format than the February drawings. The drawings remain Friday evenings at 7, but this time you need to be there if you want to win. You do need to swipe your card earlier in the day to activate your entries in the Lucky Leprechaun drawings award $7,500 each Friday night, and the winner's returning on Friday, March 28th for another $10,000 in prizes. You earn 5 times tickets Friday and Saturday evenings. The Play, Earn, and Win awards now appear to be daily events, Monday through Friday, rather than merely Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Until tomorrow, March 14th, the major gifts are gift cards usable at TJ Maxx, Marshalls, and Home Goods. Starting Monday, for 12 days in a row, Saturdays and Sundays included, the prizes are from Tiffany Jewelers, and you can save up your points towards the big prize should you so wish. VideoPoker.com remains the best place to practice a very wide variety of games, including Quick Quads, Ultimate X, Extra Draw Frenzy Poker, Hyper Bonus, and many others. Often these games are the best returning games in a casino, and you need to practice to make sure you know how to play. Their daily contest this week, they have Ultimate X, Wheel Poker, and Extra Action Poker. Ultimate X is a 10 coins per line game where you earn bonuses this time that you redeem on the next hand should you hit something on the same line. Full houses typically earn you a 12 times multiplier, so now your wet dream is a dealt full house followed by a dealt royal. I'm playing a Deuces Wild variation, and so there it's straight flushes, which gets you the 12X, so my wet dream is different than yours, but hasn't come true anyway. Richard, who's going to be our guest next week?
Next week, our guest is Dusty Schmidt, who quite a great online player known as Leather Ass. He either a professional golfer or ready to be a professional golfer until he had some health problems. So we'll talk a little bit about that as well. He has a new book coming out, or it's partially out, called Poker in Practice: Critical Concepts. So he'll be here next week.
Very good. So, Blair, you have about a minute and a quarter left. Is that enough to tell the Anthony story?
No, I'll tell you a different story. I'll tell you a golf story.
All right.
I might not be able to get that in, but one of my favorite old-timers is Dewey Tomko, and he's told me a million great stories. And he told me this one. It was back in probably the 70s when they were playing golf every day. Dewey said they were playing, and there was two foursomes, and they were playing with a bunch of hitmen. And they would come out to the golf course with all their cash in their bags and all this stuff. So they're on the tee, and there's two foursomes, and somebody came up and said, "Hey, you're going to get robbed on the first tee. There's guys out there that are going to come out and hijack you." So they just laughed. They said, "That's no problem." So they put all the four hitmen in the first group. They teed off at the Desert Inn. They got out in the fairway, and here comes these guys running out from the bushes with masks and guns, and they got about halfway and saw who it was, and they turned around and ran away.
That sounds like a smart plan.
Yeah. The old days here were pretty wild and woolly. They really were.
Yeah. Do we still have hitmen here in Vegas?
I'm sure we do. I'm sure they're everywhere, but
really
a little different back then.
I didn't know that we still had hitmen. Okay. Very good. So we've been talking to Blair Rodman, author of Kill Phil. He was on the show earlier, July 7th, 2011. Should you wish to hear more of him? Thank you very much. Good night, Richard. Go out and hit a royal flush, everybody.
Good night.
Good night, guys.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.